this is how you prove it to me.
We got to stop it, brother. Let's get together and unify.
Radio Basics.
And there's always a message involved.
The statistics on the distribution of financial wealth, I think, are some of the most underutilized statistics that the left should do more with. In Canada, for example, it's hard to get the actual detailed stuff. The richest 10% of Canadians own 60% of all financial wealth. The richest 1% owns over 30% of all financial wealth. There are 54 billionaires in Canada, okay, so that's about a third of as many people in this room. That's as many people as just from this side of the room over, 54 billionaires. They own 5% of all financial wealth in Canada, and the bottom 50% of Canadians, so that's about 17 million people, own 3% of financial wealth. So these 54 billionaires own about twice as much wealth as 17 million Canadians. It is absolutely appalling how centralized wealth has become. Yet the operation of these markets tends to obscure that and make people think that it's a game that everybody can play and everybody has a stake.
That was Jim Stanford, economist for the CAW. He joins us today on Radio Basics to discuss the nature of the GM bailout, the current state of labor in Canada, and the future of the CAW, Canada's biggest union. But first, Barack Obama delivered a speech last week in Cairo, Egypt, to the international Muslim community trying to repair decades, if not centuries, of U.S. state violence and colonialism against the Middle East and beyond.
Strong bonds with Israel are well known. This bond is unbreakable. It is based upon cultural and historical ties and the recognition that the aspiration for a Jewish homeland is rooted in a tragic history that cannot be denied. Around the world, the Jewish people were persecuted for centuries, and anti-Semitism in Europe culminated in an unprecedented Holocaust. Tomorrow, I will visit Buchenwald, which was part of a network of camps where Jews were enslaved, tortured, shot, and gassed to death by the Third Reich. 6 million Jews were killed, more than the entire Jewish population of Israel today. Denying that fact is baseless, it is ignorant, and it is hateful. Threatening Israel with destruction or repeating vile stereotypes about Jews is deeply wrong and only serves to evoke in the minds of Israelis this most painful of memories while preventing the peace that the people of this region deserve. On the other hand, it is also undeniable that the Palestinian people, Muslims and Christians, has suffered in pursuit of a homeland. For more than 60 years, they've endured the pain of dislocation. Many wait in refugee camps in the West Bank, Gaza, and neighboring lands for a life of peace and security that they have never been able to lead. They endure the daily humiliations, large and small, that come with occupation. So let there be no doubt, the situation for the Palestinian people is intolerable, and America will not turn our backs on the legitimate Palestinian aspiration for dignity, opportunity, and a state of their own. For decades, then, there has been a stalemate. Two peoples with legitimate aspirations, each with a painful history that makes compromise elusive. It's easy to point fingers. for Palestinians to point to the displacement brought about by Israel's founding, and for Israelis to point to the constant hostility and attacks throughout its history, from within its borders as well as beyond. But if we see this conflict only from one side or the other, then we will be blind to the truth. The only resolution is for the aspirations of both sides to be met through two states where Israelis and Palestinians each live in peace and security.
That was Barack Obama speaking in Cairo, Egypt, to the international Muslim community last week. Noam Chomsky, the world's most cited author, wrote this about the speech. Quote, keeping just to Israel-Palestine, Obama called on Arabs and Israelis not to point fingers at each other or to see the conflict only from one side or the other. There is, however, a third side, that of the United States, which has played a decisive role in sustaining the current conflict. Obama gave no indication that its role should change or even be considered. Those familiar with the history will rationally conclude then that Obama will continue in the path of unilateral U.S. rejectionism. End quote. Israel has blatantly refused not only the international boundaries and the UN mandates, but also defies President Obama's calls for a halt to all settlements in the West Bank. But as Chomsky notes, the U.S. provides massive foreign aid to Israel, which is crucial to its continued existence. If Obama was truly genuine in his calls to halt settlements and bring stability to the region, he would order a stop to all weapon shipments to Israel, an investigation of the most recent assault in January, which coincidentally ended a day before President Obama's inauguration. While the speech drew attention to colonialism and the word occupation was actually uttered, what we can see is merely words without any action for change.
We meet at a time of great tension between the United States and Muslims around the world. Tension rooted in historical forces that go beyond any current policy debate. The relationship between Islam and the West includes centuries of coexistence and cooperation, but also conflict and religious wars. More recently, tension has been fed by colonialism that denied rights and opportunities to many Muslims, and a Cold War in which Muslim-majority countries were too often treated as proxies without regard to their own aspirations.
That was President Obama drawing attention to U.S. colonialism's history in the Middle East. When we return from break, we will speak with Jim Stanford on the fate of the CAW and the Canadian labor force in the wake of the GM bailouts. That was Neil Young, Cough Up the Bucks, which is in theme with our next topic, which we will be discussing the state of North American labor, the CAW, and the fate of GM with Jim Stanford. Jim is one of Canada's best-known economists. He works for the Canadian Auto Workers Union, Canada's largest private sector trade union, and writes a regular economics column for the Globe and Mail. He speaks regularly to the media on current economic issues and to audiences of unions, community activists, and others concerned with building a more democratic, critical approach to economics. Jim is the founder of the Progressive Economics Forum, Canada's network of progressive economists. His previous book, Paper Boom, was well-reviewed as an accessible critique of the wasteful practices of the financial industry. His most recent book is, it's right here, it is... Jim, are you on with us?
I am. It's Economics for Everyone.
There it is, Economics for Everybody.
There we go.
A short guide to the economics of capitalism, which I must say is a great book, but hopefully we can talk more about that. So, Jim, let's start.
Jason, great to be with you, pal.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Thanks for coming on. You know, your work is well-received, and hopefully you can shed some light against the sort of anti-union puffery that passes as journalism these days.
Right on. I'd be glad to.
Okay, Jim, so let's start. Why unions? Why in particular the CAW?
Well, why unions is an easy one to answer, Jason. Here's how work is organized in our economy, which in my book I call capitalism. You don't hear that word very often, capitalism. I sometimes call it the C word.
Yeah.
Mentioning the word capitalism makes you sound like some kind of raving Bolshevik, right?
That's true.
But the reality is that's the system we have. 85% of the GDP in our economy is produced by private companies who are in it to make a private profit. And the work that is done in those companies is done in the form of what's called wage labor, where the employers hire someone for a certain wage to come in and do that work in return for a wage or salary, and then the company tries to sell the output for a profit. Now, in that relationship, that employment relationship, it's never a level playing field. The worker always needs the job more than the employer needs the worker. For any individual worker, that's always the case, because the worker needs a job to pay the bills and put food on the table. The employer needs any particular worker to do some work, but if they lose that worker, they can almost always go out and find someone else, unless the person has a very, very unique skill or something like that. So it's not a level playing field. The individual worker needs the job much more than the employer needs them. And that allows the employer to basically put the screws to the worker and try and maximize the output, maximize the work effort, and minimize the compensation. Now, a way to level the playing field is for all the workers to basically band together and try to deal with the employer as one. And that's what's called collective bargaining. If you do that, then you level the playing field a bit, because then the workers still need the job, but now the employer isn't looking at any one particular worker who's generally disposable. Now the employer is looking at the whole lot of them, the whole collective of workers, and should they decide to stop working or carry on some kind of campaign or a strike or whatever, the employer faces a genuine problem. So with collective bargaining, by forming a union and then approaching the employer as one to deal with the employer on wages and working conditions, the workers can get a lot better value from the employer, get a much better share of the wealth that they create. So that idea has motivated workers for hundreds of years to organize unions, sometimes against the most incredible odds. You know, there are times, even today in the world, where you can be killed for trying to organize a union.
Mm-hmm.
And even in Canada, you can get fired for trying to organize a union, yet workers still do it. And it's because they generally understand at their gut level that they won't get a fair deal just going one-on-one to the employer and asking for a better deal. They have to join with their colleagues. Now, in terms of the CAW, I think the CAW has got a great record in a range of industries, not just auto. Only about 10% of our members today work in the auto industry, in all kinds of industries, and showing that by organizing people, being ambitious, fighting back, you can get a better deal for them.
Mm-hmm. Jim, you seem to sort of contradict what we learn in economics class, where the principal antagonism is supply and demand. But what you seem to be saying is that it's labor and capital.
Well, I don't think that supply and demand is really that informative or accurate a way to describe how the world actually works. I don't think that the nature of employment and the way employment is organized, the nature of compensation, the nature of work organization in the workplace and how it's, you know, supervised and everything, I don't think that supply and demand actually tells you very much, even though, you know, you're quite right. I mean, I studied economics for 10 years of my life, and in most economics classes, that's all they do. They slap up a supply curve, slap up a demand curve, and where the points cross is where everything's in equilibrium.
Mm-hmm.
And apart from being wrong, that's not actually how wages are determined and employment is determined. It's also, you know, very mystifying. You know, it kind of hides the actual relationships between people, not relationships between a supply curve and a demand curve, that actually determine how work occurs. So I wouldn't say that labor versus capital is the only sort of dimension across which you want to understand work. There's also big issues about, you know, different types of workers, different skill levels, gender, race, and geography, north-south issues, and so on, that you have to draw into the picture. But there is something very fundamental about having to work for someone else in order to earn enough money to put food on the table. And that is a fact of life that about 85% of our society has in common. And I think it's very important not to forget that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. We played a clip of one of your speeches at the beginning, and you show some stats about the distribution of wealth, in which 54 billionaires control a massive proportion of the wealth, in contrast to about 50% of the population.
Yeah, in Canada, there are 54 billionaires, and they own about twice as much wealth as the bottom half of our whole population. So it is incredible. I know it's very popular in this day and age of mutual funds and RRSPs, where everybody gets to play the market. It's very popular to pretend that we can all be a capitalist just by buying a few shares in a bank or some other company.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people do that. A lot of people do have a few shares. But even adding up all of the bits and pieces that they own, it doesn't amount to very much for the vast majority of people. The real money is still owned by a surprisingly small elite of very, very rich people, even in Canada. And I know that goes against the grain, you know, of us being a more modern, inclusive society, but that is the hard reality. And it's often obscured by this emphasis we have on playing the markets and buying your RRSPs.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. So, Jim, what has free trade done to North American working class and to the CAW in general?
Oh, gosh. Well, that's a good question to be asking at this moment in time, when so many of our traditional industries in Canada are just really melting down around our feet. It's unbelievable. You know, I've just spent the entire day today in some really intense negotiations with a major company that's just trying to come out of bankruptcy protection, you know, and it's a terrible scenario to be in because you're trying to win bits and pieces of protection for your members, for your union members. And it's important to do that. The union can really make a difference. It's much better than in a non-unionized setting where the workers aren't even players at the table, you know. At least with the union, you can get in there and try and win a bit more for them. But it's a very, very negative environment in the auto industry, obviously, but in many other manufacturing sectors. Steel mills have been shut down. All kinds of manufacturing work has been lost. And other sectors of the economy, think of forestry, which, if anything, is probably in worse shape than the auto industry today. And globalization in general and the free trade agreements in particular have been an important part of that problem. You know, in the old days, in a strategic industry like the auto industry, governments would put in place kind of rules, if you like, rules of the game. We had the Auto Pact in the auto industry, which required global auto companies to produce in Canada if they wanted the right to sell to Canada without paying major tariffs. And that was actually a very effective way to go. It meant that we had our share of a very important high-tech industry and all the spin-off jobs that came with that industry. With the free trade agreement, which we first implemented with the U.S. in 1989, then we brought Mexico into the NAFTA in 1994. Then we joined the World Trade Organization in 1995. Most of those policies, what I would call industrial policies, have been thrown out the window because they contradict this new commitment to free trade. And I wouldn't say that free trade is the only problem we face. You know, it would be a mistake to try and blame everything on free trade. But it is clearly a context in which businesses have been given the power to lay off people here, shift the work to places where it's cheaper, and then sell this, bring the stuff back to Canada and sell it at Walmart. That's more or less what we've become as a country. Manufacturing in Canada has lost about 500,000 jobs now, 500,000 jobs since 2003. And the destruction is, if anything, it's accelerating with the current financial crisis and the current recession. And those are good jobs for a working class person. They're jobs where you could earn a decent living and support a family. And for people who aren't engineers or software designers and other so-called members of the creative class, as it's often referred to, a manufacturing job is one of the only ways you can get decent wages. So it's a terrible situation that we face. On the other hand, working people will always fight back and try to get something better. And so we have seen some encouraging signs of fight back around pensions, around plant closures and severance pay and that kind of thing. And that's what gives me hope to kind of carry on, you know.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Okay, so I'm going to pretend to be a National Post reporter right now, working for that rag of a newspaper.
Okay.
And I'm going to sort of repeat what is so-called popular opinion out there. One being that unions were once necessary, but not anymore.
You know, it's funny to hear that quote because I can tell you that people said that quote in the 1700s. You know, there were unions that were formed in the 1600s, and anti-union people in the 1700s said, "Oh, well, times were tough in the 1600s. Maybe you needed a union then, but we don't need them now." Mm-hmm. The same was true in the 1800s and 1900s. I've got a great quote from the guy, I forget his name, he was the right-wing premier of Ontario during the Depression, and he was very anti-union, and he had said exactly the same thing in the Great Depression. Well, maybe unions were necessary in the 1870s, but they're not necessary today. Unions will always be necessary because that fundamental power imbalance between workers who need a job, each individual worker needs a job to put food on the table, but to an employer, any individual worker is dispensable. They can always be replaced. And the only way to even that power situation is for the workers to get together and have a collective voice, a common voice.
Mm-hmm.
So we have seen unions, we've seen unions lose some of their power in Canada. A little under 30% of workers in Canada currently belong to a union, compared to, say, 40% in the late 70s and early 80s. And a consequence of that erosion in union power has definitely been an erosion of workers' share of the national pie. Workers' real wages in Canada, adjusted for inflation, have not grown at all in the last quarter century, which is incredible when you think about how hard people are working and how much new technology there is and so on. So if you want to have a decent distribution of income, if you want working people to get a fair share of what they produce, unions are as essential today as they ever were.
Mm-hmm. Okay, number two.
Are you still a National Post reporter?
Yeah, okay, still going.
You're still wearing that mask. Okay.
Yeah, unions and CAW workers are greedy and make too much money. Some estimates say $74 an hour.
Well, that's a weird number that's out there. You're referring to a number that is about the auto assembly industry, people who work in car assembly plants.
Right.
Now, that's not a typical CAW member.
Mm-hmm.
A member, only about 10% of our members work in the auto assembly plants. The other 90% work in a whole range of other sectors.
Mm-hmm.
And then that $74 an hour is ridiculous. That's just a total lie. Our members in the auto sector, in an auto assembly plant, their wage is $34 an hour. if you're a skilled tradesperson, like if you have a special ticket like a machinist or electrician or something like that, you make $40 an hour. And then on top of that, you get benefits that are worth about $10 an hour in total, your pension, your health care benefits, other benefits that you get. So now that's definitely a decent wage, a good wage, a wage that you can raise a family on. I think it's a fair wage. People forget how hard it is to work in a factory. An auto assembly factory is this incredible machine where you've got, you know, basically 700 people or so on any one shift, all glued to the assembly line, and you have to do the same action over every 45 seconds or so, and there's this incredible pressure of the assembly line that moves, whether you're ready for it or not. And it's exhausting both mentally and physically, and there's lots of injuries, repetitive strain injuries and so on. So it's not an easy job, but it is a very highly productive job. Each auto worker on average produces about $300,000 of value added, that's GDP, per worker in a year. So every worker puts out $300,000, and then their income might be $70,000 or $75,000. So yes, they're well paid at $70,000 or $75,000, but they've more than done the job in terms of what they churn out in their work life, and I think it's a fair share. That hasn't stopped the politicians and the National Post reporters and so on from using the workers as the scapegoat. They see the auto industry in trouble, and they say, oh, it must be the workers. And there's no justification for that. You know, we could work for free. This isn't an exaggeration. CAW members could work for free, and General Motors would still be bankrupt because of the loss of market share that they've experienced, the declining output, and the rise of imports that have come into our market. So the wages are fair, they're decent, absolutely, but they're not the problem.
Mm-hmm, yes, hopefully we can touch upon GM more specifically in a bit. Okay, I've taken my horns off. I'm not working
okay.
for the National Post anymore.
Right. Now you work for some good left-wing newspaper.
Community Radio, that's
good.
Right.
Yeah. Very good.
Okay, so Jim, talk about lean production, as it's called, as adopted by Toyota and Honda, and what it means for workers.
Well, there's been this trend to what's called lean production over the last 20 or 30 years, I guess you'd say. It's certainly not just Toyota and Honda. I would say it's virtually universal in the manufacturing industry. What's happened is that under the force of global competition and the desire to try and maximize profits, plant managers have been relentless in kind of looking at how their factories work, examining each and every motion of the workers to make sure that there's no wasted motion, that every action is finely tuned to producing the product and not doing anything else. And it's a way of trying to boost productivity and reduce costs of production. So I've got nothing against higher productivity as a goal, that's fine. The best way to do it is through, you know, technology and machinery and so on. But this relentless emphasis on intensifying work, making sure there's never a moment wasted, basically, is the ultimate goal of lean production. That kind of productivity can be very dangerous for workers in terms of repetitive strain injuries and exhaustion and stress and health and safety. So I think, competition has brought some things in life that are good, but some things in life that are bad. And I'd say a downside of competition has been this emphasis on intensifying the workplace, and that's had consequences on the quality of work life and on the health and safety of the workers. That's why one thing a union always does, in fact, you know, it's bargaining over wages and pensions that often gets the headlines. But the thing that unions do that bosses hate the most, I think, even more than pushing up wages, is the power of unions to try and put some limits on the sort of intensity of work in the workplace, to try and say, you know, there's limits to how far you can push a person, push a human body. It's only fair to give people, a 10-minute break every 2 hours or whatever. Those are the things that sometimes the bosses hate even more than the impact of unions on wages and benefits.
Mm-hmm, yeah. Yeah, definitely. I also heard that like places like Toyota and Honda, you have to work, you could be scheduled up to 60 hours with no overtime. And it's something you agree to in your contract when you first sign up.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. Yeah, and that seems incredible in this day and age. But the reality is sometimes even your basic legal standards, your legal work standards, to things like, you know, there's legal regulations governing things like vacation pay or severance pay or time off the job or issues if you work in the service industry, say in restaurants. There's legal minimums around things like minimum call-in periods and that kind of a thing, shift scheduling. Sometimes those legal rights are only on paper. You don't actually, as an individual worker, have any real power to enforce them. Like, you know, you can complain to the government if your employer isn't following the rules, but A, is anything going to happen? You know, no guarantees. Mm-hmm. And B, you could get fired. You could get your ass fired before anything was done about it, right?
Yep.
And so sometimes one of the biggest impacts of a union is just to enforce the rules, to enforce the laws that are out there in theory for all workers, whether you're in a union or not. But without a union, you don't have any realistic ability to enforce those rules. And what you've given of people working 60-hour weeks with no overtime pay is a very good example of that.
Mm-hmm.
One thing we actually did was with the Toyota workers, even though they're not in the union, there was a group of them that were fighting against this excessive hours of work, and we backed them in a case through the workplace standards provincially, and we won. So go figure, they got their hours cut, and the company Toyota had to pay some extra pay to them, even though they weren't members of the union. Hopefully they'll learn if they want that kind of respect in the workplace, they need to have a union there all the time.
Mm-hmm, definitely. So, Jim, the CAW seems to be suffering a public relations crisis. So many denounce sort of its narrow focus in terms of just securing, say, GM pensions. And many non-union workers sort of feel that the CAW gains at their expense. Is that a failure of the CAW, do you feel?
Well, I think in some regards it's fair to criticize us for that. I mean, it is certainly true that our first priority is to defend the interests of our members.
Mm-hmm.
Now, our members are not just, you know, the so-called fat cats who work in auto plants. As I said, 90% of our members don't work in auto plants, and we're defending their rights all the time, too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whether it's people who work at Dominion stores, you know, or people who work at Air Canada, or people who drive trucks for a living, or people who work in nursing homes. Those are all people in our union, and we're fighting for their rights as well, and none of those people are paid anything like auto workers. It is very, very important, though, for unions to position themselves as a voice for all workers, if you like. We cannot be seen as just a kind of special interest or a vested interest group. And, for example, in the way we were fighting over pensions with the GM case that just got concluded, we tried to position that as a fight for everyone's pension, to first of all argue that everyone had the right to a pension. In Canada, that right is not respected. Three-quarters of workers in the private sector get no pension at all from their employer. Can you believe that? No pension at all. And that's fundamentally wrong. So we tried to highlight that failure. We tried to call on government to strengthen public pensions and strengthen public pension regulations covering all workers, and argued that, you know, GM workers fighting for their pension, and successfully, in the end, we won that battle, and we did protect our pension. But that was a kind of a symbol, if you like, for the struggle of all workers for the right to retire with dignity. And that's an incredibly important thing I've found over the years for working people. To know there's a pension for them at the end of their career is like a light at the end of the tunnel that gets them through the tough days when they really, really don't want to go to work, you know?
Yeah. Yeah,
and strengthening pensions, I think, is a really important goal. And unions should do the same with other issues. Again, not just to be seen to be protecting their own members, but to be fighting for things that matter to all workers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think the CAW could really sort of show some excellent leadership, especially in that role, and encourage people to join. Right. So.
Well, certainly we have, you know, our union organizers who are out all the time, and even just regular rank and file members. If they know someone who's not being treated well in their job, pass them some literature, help them sign some union cards, see what kind of interest there is. Because the attitudes have kind of shifted against unions, the legal protections for unions are weak. Employers are more aggressive and sophisticated in fighting unionization than they've ever been.
Mm-hmm.
It's very hard to organize unions in Canada, but we have to be able to do that. We have to have breakthroughs. Otherwise, we'll become a shrinking and shrinking and shrinking minority, and that would be the end of us as a movement. Organizing new unions and attracting new members, as you say, is an absolute do-or-die task for our movement, I believe.
Mm-hmm. Jim, we have to go to commercial break. Hopefully you'll stick around and we can discuss your article on the so-called bailout afterwards.
Right on. I'll stay on the line, Jason.
Okay, and I'm going to play a clip before we go to break from author Michael Yates, retired economics professor, who wrote a book, Why Unions Matter, that I encourage people to read. And that'll take us to break, and we'll come back with Jim Stanford of the CAW.
Well, to somebody who said something like that.
Well, I would just say that I don't know how the workers could ruin an industry that they don't own. I mean, all the basic decisions, I would say probably where the union went wrong was conceding so many decisions to the employers in terms of how the plants are run, what kind of technology is used, how hard the workers work, you know, what the daily work routine is like, the price of the product, the kinds of products, the environmental aspects of production. The union conceded all of those to the employer. And it seems to me that where the companies went wrong was that they made an awful lot of bad decisions in terms of the kinds of cars that they made. And the union had actually GM on record in a previous contract in favor of national health insurance. And the company had agreed to push and lobby for that, but it never did. And the union never held its feet to the fire about that either. So I would say that you have a so-called free enterprise system, then the owners are the responsible party. Anything that they agreed to in the bargaining, they agreed to. You know, anything that's in the contract, the employers agreed to that, saw it in their interest to agree to that. And so how you could blame the workers for what's gone wrong with the auto industry is beyond me. And not only that, but if you think about the kinds, I mean, if you look at it from just the point of view of aggregate demand, the workers making pretty good money, having decent benefits and so on and so forth is good for the economy as a whole because they buy things.
Okay, CHRY 105.5. We are back with Jim Stanford, an economist for the CAW. Jim, you still there?
I am, Jason. How are you?
Hey, pretty good, man. Did you get to hear that that little excerpt from Michael Yates?
Yes, I did. Yes, he's an American guy. Your audience mm-hmm. should know he was talking about the American situation,
right.
But that was very interesting, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and again, he was sort of reiterating what you were saying, maybe about pensions, but in terms of health care, if the union sort of pushed for a national health care policy in the United States, which is a very tough task, that would take a lot of cost off employers, right? And obviously benefit all workers.
Yeah, no, that would be very important in the U.S. Setting. And the main reason for national health care in the U.S. is just to give Americans a chance for decent health care protection, mm-hmm. not because it makes it cheaper for employers. But
mm-hmm.
So that's the main reason to fight it for. But a side benefit is that it would help the auto industry and others be more successful. We should be cautious, though, because there's no guarantees. In Canada, we do have public health care.
Right.
It is an important source of our cost advantage, yet we're still losing
yeah.
tens of thousands of jobs and closing plants. So that's where, on some level, you have to be ready to put some rules in place on globalization to try and push companies to produce in Canada if they're going to sell their products in Canada. And that, at the end of the day, will be the only way we can really protect our jobs.
Definitely. So, Jim, in regards to your article, it is called Don't Blame Auto Bailout for the $50 billion Deficit, posted on the Progressive Economics Forum on May 28th, 2009. So could you discuss this article as it refers to the GM, quote, bailout, and address if this bailout was necessary for Ontario and for workers?
Well, that article was written in response to all these folks, you know, like your old buddy from the National Post, you know, or the Fraser Institute and so on, who were arguing that the reason the government deficit was so big was because the government was, quote unquote, bailing out the auto industry. Now, I don't like that term bailout. What's actually happening is the governments are giving loans, commercial repayable loans to GM and Chrysler, with very strict conditions about GM and Chrysler's continued production in Canada. And like any other loans, they're actually coming from a government-owned bank, the Export Development Corporation. The loans have to be repaid. So it isn't a bailout and it isn't a handout. It's an investment by the government to try and keep these companies going here. And the reality is the deficit would be far, far worse if the government allowed these companies to collapse, because then you'd lose all of the jobs, not just the direct jobs, but all the spin-off jobs. There's about 7.5 jobs in total for every job in a major auto plant, and then you'd lose the taxes that are paid by all those people who are working. The economic studies indicate that if GM and Chrysler collapsed entirely, the federal government would lose about $10 billion each year in tax revenue, and the provincial government would lose $3 billion each year. So, you know, that's where this decision to assist the auto companies, while it was expensive, was less costly than the alternative, which was letting them fall completely.
Sorry, continue.
No, that was just my point. Yeah, it was actually, first of all, it may end up costing the taxpayers nothing in the end. If the companies stay alive and repay those commercial loans, the government will actually make money. So then it's a mistake to count it as part of the deficit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. I can speak from my own personal experience. I work for a manufacturing company that makes lubricants, which applies to a company that makes car frames, whose biggest customer is GM.
Uh-huh.
So I'm third down the line. And then we buy raw material from other companies.
Right.
Right, so you can see how it's just a chain that could fracture all the links.
That's right, almost. Yeah.
So, Jim, why is the government so reluctant to make the auto industry public? If the CAW and the government are major shareholders, why can't we act like owners and not, say, private equity funds? Where we could take sort of these plants that they're going to close and convert them into publicly financed producers of electric powered cars or solar panels and things like that. I mean, if the tool and the ownership is there, why not the will?
First of all, Jason, the CAW is not a shareholder in these companies. We don't own any shares directly or indirectly. Right. The government will be a minority shareholder. I think they're going to own 2% of Chrysler and 10%, I guess, or 12% of GM. The government's view is that that will be a temporary shareholding, and they will sell off their shares as soon as they're able as a way of getting some of the money that they've lent to the companies back. I'm sympathetic to the principle of trying to use public investment to create jobs in key industries where they wouldn't exist otherwise. I don't think that just taking over the auto companies alone, though, would really do the trick. I think we would need to have a major sort of proactive strategy to build up that kind of green car industry that you're imagining, and public ownership could be part of it. We'd also have to have rules and regulations on globalization. I mean, producing electric cars doesn't save us in the end if you can still import the electric cars from Mexico or China or somewhere else for a third of the price that they cost to make them here. You still have that fundamental problem of globalization behind the scenes. So I think that, you know, this idea of developing green industries and building them in Canada is a very important one, and public ownership could play a role in that. But you also need the broader economic tools, like trying to put some limits on globalization if those strategies are going to be successful.
Mm-hmm. How come, say, the sort of ideology around free trade still exists, that people still believe this is a good thing for workers?
Well, I don't know. Does the word brainwashing mean anything to you? I suppose. Right. It's very powerful. You know, you've got the mainstream newspapers and everything that are promoting that idea. And it's up to us to provide alternatives. First of all, to provide the evidence as to why free trade hasn't made everyone better off. You know, all of these promised gains in productivity and income and job creation that were promised when we had free trade didn't come to pass. Secondly, how it's hurting us further these days. And then thirdly, what some of the alternatives are. You know, earlier in this interview, I mentioned the Auto Pact, mm-hmm. that idea that a company should be required to produce here if they're going to sell here. Who knows? We might be headed back in that direction, because this whole restructuring deal with GM and Chrysler, the government did, in fact, require that. As a condition of that assistance, the government said you have to produce a certain share of your output in Canada. That's the first time we've had government telling corporations they had to produce here since the Auto Pact. And that aspect of the deal is very, very positive. Now, it turns out the government had to put a bunch of money in order to get that power. But what if, you know, just imagine for a moment we told every automaker that they had to produce here as a condition of having access to our market, then we might not see the job loss that we're seeing all around us today. So I think there's an opportunity because this free market approach has failed so badly. Just look around the economy of the world today, and it's failed so badly. We have a chance to point out the flaws of that vision and what the alternatives are.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. So, Jim, from your experience being in the negotiations firsthand, what do you think is the fate of these companies and working people in general?
In Canada, you mean?
Right.
Yeah, well, the companies are going to survive. There's no doubt about that. Mm-hmm. Now, they may want to survive by moving all their plants to China, right? And just exporting the products back to us. The bigger issue is how are we going to keep the industries we need here in Canada? And, you know, again, I think if we continue down that path of total leave it to business, free trade, globalization, et cetera, we'll be left with two kinds of industries in Canada. We'll be left with industries that dig stuff out of the ground,
right?
Because we know all the resources are here and you can't move those. And then we'll be left with industries like Walmart and Tim Hortons that sell stuff, you know? And all of the other industries that produce real value and create decent jobs will be in jeopardy. So all that being said, you know, that's, I think, a pessimistic view if we carry on with the rules of the game as they currently are. But I also am optimistic. I don't think it's just the Prozac I take with my orange juice every morning, although that helps.
Right. Yeah, we...
I'm optimistic that people are always going to fight for a better deal when they feel they're being ripped off. And the failure of this kind of free market approach to things leaves some openings for us to promote some different alternatives.
Mm-hmm, definitely. And it really falls on those that are adversely affected, you know, to organize and to educate. And I think your book, Economics for Everybody, really does that job. I mean, I haven't gotten through the whole thing, but from what I read, it really demystifies a lot of what is almost made purposely boring economics as a subject, right? So people will stay away, and you sort of you have roadmaps and you explain things quite well, and you know, it's appreciated, especially at Basics. We do a lot of organizing work and stuff, and it's a good tool and a good weapon.
I really appreciate that, Jason. Thank you. That's the goal, is to make it accessible to everyone so everyone can have their own arguments as to why we can do things better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. Is there any other places people can access maybe your work or websites where people can get some information or education out there?
Well, I'll list two websites. One is the website for the book itself,
mm-hmm.
and that's just www.economicsforeveryone.ca. And there's information and excerpts from the book, a whole list of supplementary readings, like student exercises and that kind of thing for people who want to organize courses around the book. Another website that's really good is www.progressive-economics.ca. Progressive-economics.ca. That's the Progressive Economics Forum. We've got a blog site there where there's about, I don't know, eight of us. Lefty economists who put out, you know, daily updates on what the issues of the day are and try to come at things from a different perspective.
Mm-hmm. Jim Stanford, thanks so much for being on. You're definitely a friend of Basics, and hope we can have you on to explain things that are purposely made boring and mystified. So,
all right, great to be with you, Jay. Keep up the good work there.
Okay, thanks, Jim.
Okay.
Yes, that was Jim Stanford, the economist for the CAW. You know, and I highly recommend this book for anyone that is trying to educate unions and just trying to get educated about the forces that control our lives. Jim makes a good point at the beginning. You know, the only thing that separates capitalism from any other sort of economic system is really how we organize ourselves and how we relate to other people. Every society has had some sort of property, has had exchange, you know, trading between people. But what really separates it is, you know, the fact that some people have to sell themselves into work and some people don't. And those people have the power. And again, as 54 billionaires in Canada against half the population, isn't just people with, you know, big bank accounts and mutual funds, but that hold a lot of social power and a lot of social influence. And I don't even think that's a hard argument to make, especially in the wake of, you know, the massive transfers of wealth to financial institutions. You know, and most of us are trying to get EI, which is, you know, a tough enough task in itself. So that's it for Radio Basics. This has been, you know, part one, I hope, of a series on labor, on working class people, and the sort of the fate of Ontario. You know, so tune into Basics every Monday, 8 p.m. And, you know, we share some knowledge. So thanks for tuning in. I'm going to, again, go with my man Neil Young, keeping with the theme of the show. So have a good one. See you next week.